So for ordinary Iranians and for Iranian civil society, the deal was a step forward. But there was also a part of the Iranian regime that does fear American influence and that was not very happy to see the deal signed, that also didn't trust it. I think Khamenei's line from the very beginning was, go ahead, sign this deal, but the Americans are not to be trusted. They're not going to stick by it. So the noise coming out of the Trump administration is music to those ears.
That's Laura Secor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Laura Secor on Iran, history and politics. Iran, a country of 80 million people, strategically straddles West and South Asia. Once in Washington's hip pocket, Iran dramatically left the U.S. orbit in 1979, when the Shah was overthrown and the Islamic Republic was established. The loss, in quotes, of Iran was a major blow to Washington's policy of dominating the Middle East and controlling its oil. Pretty much ever since, the countries have been at loggerheads. The nuclear deal of 2015 was a breakthrough. However, there's a new sheriff in town, and the rhetoric coming from the White House is belligerent. The president has tweeted, "Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind," in quotes, "President Obama was to them. Not me," he exclaimed. Calling Iran the number one terror state, he put it on the travel ban list. What's going on inside Iran is largely unknown. Most media reports omit context and background. Our guest today is Laura Secor. She's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Foreign Affairs, and other publications. She's the author of Children of Paradise, The Struggle for the Soul of Iran. I talked with her at the University of Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's give our listeners a sense of Iranian identity. I guess all cultures are unique and singular, but Iran has some, I think, qualities that make it very distinctive: language, music, poetry, Shia Islam, the fact that it's an ancient civilization. What did you discover about this ancient modern culture?
All the things that you name are important components of Iranian culture. I guess some of the things that surprised me or that I might not have known before going there have to do more with the modern culture and the modern political culture of the country. This is a place that has a very engaged citizenry, and it also has a very interesting intellectual culture that prizes abstract ideas and philosophy. It's an extremely dynamic place where I think we in the United States, we tend to think a lot about Iranian culture in terms of religion. But religion is really but one piece of a more complex intellectual puzzle. So that was one thing that was interesting to learn about, was the role of religion in Iranian public and private life. And yes, and just exactly how modern a country it's become. This is a place that has had really rapid urbanization in the course of the last century, and where most people now do live under urban conditions. And this has had an enormous effect on the culture.
Well, for Americans of a certain generation, their views of Iran were shaped and, I'll say, jaundiced by the U.S. Embassy in Tehran seizure in 1979 and the subsequent hostage taking. Every night, Ted Koppel on ABC News would begin his broadcast, you know, seriously intoning, "It's day 310 of the hostage crisis. It's day 311. But have people moved on from that defining moment of what happened in 79 and 80. And also, it was interesting that the hostages were released on the very day of Ronald Reagan's inauguration, which struck many as an extraordinary coincidence.
I think the hostage crisis has a real sort of outsized presence in American political life. And it's the first international political event that entered my consciousness as a child. And I think it was certainly had a sort of major impact on Americans' view of their own country and of their place in the world at the end of the 70s. That said, in Iran, it served a very different function. And this came at the time of the revolution. You had this really sort of diverse and multifarious revolutionary movement that had toppled the Shah, and there was a contest for power within the factions of that movement. So the hostage crisis was in many ways a domestic political gambit on the Iranian side, and that's something that we don't maybe appreciate enough looking at it from the American point of view. Among the Iranians, it helped to solidify Khomeini's hold on power. And it did so by first sidelining these sort of liberal nationalists who were controlling the provisional government, who Khomeini didn't wholly trust and who still had ties to the United States. Not really ties, but they were able to be intermediaries in a way that the radical clerics did not trust. And also it was a way of sidelining the secular and religious left, which had sort of claimed the mantle of anti-imperialism, and now Khomeini appropriated that for himself by allying himself with the students who seized the embassy. So it was a major political gambit in the post-revolutionary tumult inside Iran, and it sort of solidified the hold on power of a particular coterie of radical clerics, and it made the careers of a number of the students who actually seized the embassy and held the hostages. Being a hostage taker is actually a credential in Iranian politics. I still saw it even my last time there. I would still see it on the bios of candidates for parliament. This was something that, you know, it was a claim to legitimacy and to revolutionary rectitude.
What about the impact and influence of the 1953 Operation Ajax CIA coup, which overthrew the fairly popular and liberal Mohammad Mossadegh?
That was, I mean, if we're going back now to the revolutionary movement itself, that was certainly part of the battery of grievances that the revolutionaries were able to marshal against the United States, and part of the story of why it was that Iran needed to free itself from foreign influence. There's a whole interesting and new historiography around that question now that I haven't had a chance to fully explore, but just to kind of give you a hint of it, there are a bunch of new books debating the question of to what extent different Iranian forces participated in that coup. There's no question that the United States played a role in fomenting it. How significant that role was and who else was working in collaboration with those forces, all of that is still subject to actually like rather acrimonious debate. So that's kind of an interesting area that I haven't had a chance to explore in full, but it's certainly part of the narrative that brought us to 1979.
Talk a bit about the intellectual origins of the Islamic Revolution. You write about Ali Shariati, who died in 1977 at the young age of 44. You write that, quote, his ideas were indispensable to the Iranian Revolution. Who was he and why was he important?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on Shariati because it seemed to me that he, although we, from outside Iran, we hear and think a lot about Khomeini, I don't believe that there may really have even been a revolution without Shariati. If there's one major intellectual progenitor of the Iranian Revolution, I would put it on Shariati. And the reason for that is that Shariati brought together these two very, very powerful strains of resistance to the Shah. One was Islamist and the other came from the left. So Shariati was not a cleric. He was a lay religious thinker. And the formula that he developed and that was so potent in this time. The secular left was a very powerful force in Iranian intellectual life prior to the revolution. The sort of the major opposition to the Shah came from the secular left and was influenced by Marxism.
So would that be the Tudeh Party?
The Tudeh Party was certainly a piece of that movement, and it was also sort of in a more dispersed way on college campuses and it permeated the literary output of the country as well. So that being the case, someone like Shariati, what he saw was that this kind of leftism was associated with the highly educated, with the educated elite of the country, whereas the sort of the popular masses, who were also quite discontent in this period, were more invested in tradition and religion. And he brought these two things together in a way that was tremendously empowering for ordinary religious people. And what he argued was not that that Marxism and Islam were compatible, but that all the best ideas that you could find in Marxism actually originated in Islam. So he made this argument for a militant Shiism. He claimed that the way Shiism was practiced, which was quietist, meaning it was not religious or invested, I mean, it was not political or invested in political disputes, that this was a perversion of the real Shiism of Ali, which was militant and justice-seeking and promoted a classless society and all of these things that you associate with Marx. So he took these ideas that were really resonant from the left, and he attributed them in some way or derived them. He was able to make them sort of organically of a piece with the religious tradition of the country. And this was from a point of view not only of the intellect, but also of identity. It had a really powerful effect. There are a couple people in the book, or people even whose stories didn't make it into the book, but what really struck me talking to them about Shariati when they were young people and revolutionaries and inspired by Shariati, the reason for some of them was that maybe they came from families from the countryside who were traditional, and they migrated into a city like Tehran, and they felt that the educated elites looked down on them and saw them as backward because they veiled or adhered to strict Islamic traditions. Well, Shariati gave them the most sort of subversive and radical revolutionary ideology as their birthright, which they would know better than all those educated people.
Ali being the fourth caliph of Islam and the cousin and I believe son-in-law of the Prophet, he and his lineage really forms the basis of what is the other major division in Islam, Shia Islam. Shortly after the revolution in September of 1980, Iraq invades Iran, setting off an 8-year war which had a devastating effect with hundreds of thousands of casualties on both sides. Did that attack by Iraq, which was pretty much supported by the West and the U.S. to a great extent, did that limit the maneuverability of opponents of the regime because the country was under attack and we felt we have to defend our country?
Absolutely. And this is one of the oldest tricks in the authoritarian playbook. Yes, the attack of Iraq on Iran, which at the outset the West did not support but looked the other way. So, consider later on when Saddam Hussein would breach the Kuwaiti border, the United States reacted very differently. But in 80, when it was Iran, which was still holding American hostages, that was attacked by Saddam Hussein's forces, the United States and other Western powers kind of pretended it wasn't happening for a while. Then they said a pox on both their houses and established supposedly a arms boycott on both countries, but actually secretly supplied Iraq with arms and intelligence. The war allowed Khomeini to consolidate power between the hostage crisis, the war, and some other domestic factors. This regime was able to create a kind of siege mentality, which was important to consolidating its hold on power, eliminating its domestic opposition, and setting itself up for the long-term governance of the country, and instituting Khomeini's own preferred system of government, which was largely theocratic, though we can talk more about the structure of the Constitution. But in terms of, I just wanted to sort of flag with the Iran-Iraq war that the hostage crisis, I said earlier that this was something that has a bigger role in the American imagination in some ways than the Iranian. There's a really kind of interesting and wonderful book called Becoming Enemies that collects some documents from that period and looks at how it is that Americans and Iranians perceived this moment of rupture. And their conclusion was that the Iranians still don't understand how important the hostage crisis was to Americans, and the Americans still don't understand how important the Iran-Iraq war was to Iranians. That from the Iranian point of view, the American refusal to hold Iraq to its own borders at that time, it showed Iran that they were alone in the world and that they had to strategize their own security, and to hell with international convention and with anybody else. Now, the Iran-Iraq war took a really dark turn. After the Iranians expelled Iraq from their territory, which they did in relatively short order, they decided to continue to fight the Iraqis and to continue the war to Baghdad. So they then turned and invaded Iraq, and the war continued until 1988. There are plenty of historians who say that the Iranians did this because it was in Khomeini's interest to maintain the siege mentality and to continue to have the country on a war footing. And then there are others who say, well, this had to do with their vision of strategic depth and their solitude in the world.
Now, this seems to be a uniquely Iranian term in their theocratic lexicon, Veliyat-e Fahri. What is that?
Mm-hmm. That is, you know, Khomeini, before he became supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, when he was in exile under the Shah, he wrote a book called Islamic Government, or in Persian it was called Velayat-e Fahri. And this book laid out his vision of a system of Islamic government. He believed that the people were, as he put it in one speech, possibly in that book, that the people were like kindergartners in need of a shepherd, essentially. It was a very paternalistic view of the state. It would have at the pinnacle of power a highly qualified Islamic jurist like himself, and the law of the land would be the scripture. So there would be no need of a parliament or of elected representatives, because basically the supreme leader would be the viceroy of God on earth and the country would be ruled by God. Now, as it turned out, this is not how Velayat-e Fahri was implemented in Iran. And part of the reason for that was that at the beginning of the revolution, there was a provisional government that was run by technocrats who were sort of liberal nationalists. They were religious, but not Islamist in the sense of wishing to impose a system like Velayat-e Fahri. And they were charged with drafting the first constitution. So they drafted a constitution that was based on the French Fifth Republic. And it had an elected parliament and a president, and it derived its legitimacy from the consent of the governed. This was not wholly acceptable to the clerics who were the popular leaders of the country at that time, Khomeini, namely. So they had an assembly that was to revise the constitution, and that assembly imposed a vision of Velayat-e Fahri on top of that constitution. So they added a supreme leader, which in the first instance was Khomeini, and they added these bodies of clerics that would kind of vet the work of the elected government, like the Guardian Council, and something later came in called the Expediency Council. So what you had was this kind of bifurcated form of government, which on the one hand derives its legitimacy from the people and has elected representatives and channels the will of the people, and on the other hand derives its legitimacy from God and does not have elected representatives and can impose its will on the elected institutions of the state. So this is the sort of fundamental tension of the Iranian state.
Yeah, I was wondering how a state could be Islamic and a republic simultaneously.
And that is how. And this is not an easily soluble tension. This is part of what my book is really all about, is how the people on the inside of that Islamic Republic, on the inside of that system, which is really unique in the world, how they have negotiated this problem, because it is a problem. And the lines of authority are never totally, well, they are clear to the extent that the theocracy controls the instruments of coercion. The supreme leader and the sort of the councils that report to him are largely in charge of the judiciary, the Revolutionary Guard, the intelligence apparatus, and the security state, which is enormously significant. That is sort of a monopoly of violence. On the other hand, you have the president and the parliament and the ministers who are enacting policy and who do respond to a constituency. So this is actually really generative tension, which has produced factionalization inside this regime. So you've always had a range of different political viewpoints that are in conflict with each other.
Sort out these terms that are often used to describe Iranian politicians: hardliners, moderates, and reformers. Who are they?
And that's also difficult because this system, it doesn't have political parties that like we know of. It's not like you call yourself a reformist and you join the reformist party and that's who you are. There are factions which sometimes overlap and they sometimes cross, and they are fluid in a sense. But you can sort of roughly map the spectrum at any given time. The reformists were a particular piece of that spectrum. They started out as hardline radicals, meaning that they were They were actually the people who took the hostages. They were called the Islamic Left in the 80s. They were for exporting the revolution. They were for a pretty radical Islamization of the society. And they were extremely anti-imperialist and redistributionist in their economic policies. They made a turn after 1989. They lost power. And they kind of spent some time in the wilderness rethinking some of their ideas, and they came back as reformists. So by reformists, we're talking about people who have looked at the Islamic Republic, which they helped build, and said, this is not really working the way that we intended it to, and we would like to make space for more democratic attributes. So they support civil liberties, greater freedoms of expression and association, a more representative government. At a certain time, they were really working on sort of building a civil society and mechanisms by which the government would respond to the people. That faction is not really very much a part of the political space today. When we talk about Rouhani, the current president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, he's often referred to as a moderate. I prefer the term pragmatist. There was always a piece of the Iranian political spectrum that was associated with the late Ayatollah Rafsanjani, which were pragmatic centrists. They were neither left, which at this point means reformist, nor really right, which we might associate with Khamenei, but they kind of walked a middle line, and they were flexible. They wanted to take a realist approach to foreign policy. They were willing to negotiate and cooperate where need be, but they looked out for Iranian interests and had a pragmatic approach to the economy as well, and even to the domestic affairs. So that's where I would situate Rouhani. And I think the term moderate is confusing because it's actually a relative term and not really a designation of a faction.
Khomeini dies in June of 1989, and Ali Khamenei, who is also a cleric, an ayatollah, becomes the supreme leader. Now, what was the process in his becoming supreme leader? Was he just anointed by Khomeini?
Not exactly, though in the end, there is something to that. There is supposed to be a body of clerics called the Assembly of Experts that chooses the leader should the supreme leader be incapacitated. And this body, well, it's partly elected, but it's the candidates are chosen by another clerical body, so that's another story. And at the time that Khomeini died, there was no real agreement on who was going to be the next leader. Khamenei was selected by compromise, and one of the major forces behind his selection was actually Rafsanjani. After Khomeini died, we had this sort of realignment of power where Rafsanjani was the president and Khamenei was the leader. And it seems like Rafsanjani imagined that Khamenei would be a pliant supreme leader and that he would remain the real power behind the throne. It didn't work out that way. Khamenei became, he was, when he became supreme leader, a sort of moderate cleric. He was on the right, but not, he was not extreme in any way. He was also not a very high-ranking cleric. He had to very quickly become an ayatollah. And so there was always a little bit of resentment about that. There had been a successor picked out for Khomeini back in the early 80s, who was a much more distinguished ayatollah, this guy Hossein Ali Montazeri. But Montazeri had objected when Khomeini was involved in ordering the execution of political prisoners in 1988. And after Montazeri issued this objection, he was disinherited. He could no longer become the leader. So Khamenei had been shadowed from the beginning by, in some quarters, a feeling that he had usurped the position from Montazeri, and in others that he didn't have the clerical qualifications. And I think these were among the reasons that he entered that role in a kind of brittle frame of mind. He's only become more brittle with the passage of time.
What prompted that purge and political killings in 1988?
Well, like I said, the revolutionary movement was very large and diverse. There were a lot of different forces in it, not all of which were in favor of Velayat-e Faqih. So in those early years, there were some really pitched battles between the new regime and those who opposed clerical power. Mainly, the two most sort of powerful groups that were not in government and that the regime saw as a threat were the secular left and this group called the Mujahideen-e Khalq. And they were... The Mujahideen were, at that time, they were leftist, they were religious, and they were anti-clerical. So they were a sort of Islamist group that had a Marxist bent, but that did not favor the rule of the clerics, and they were seen as particularly threatening to the clerical elite. They had been very militant in the revolution. They were men under arms, a lot of them, and that was part of why they were really useful in the revolutionary moment and very dangerous after it. So that movement and the secular left were really targeted as enemies during the sort of period of consolidation in the 80s. And a lot of them were swept up into the prisons, which were at well beyond capacity by the late 80s. And in 1988, there was this order that came down from Khomeini that ordered those prisons cleared out and many thousands of people killed. There were these panels that met with the prisoners and asked them to renounce their views, asked them a very short series of questions, and depending on their answers, mostly had them executed. So this was a very traumatic event in the early history of the Islamic Republic.
In terms of support, popular support, what is the base of that for the regime?
It's hard to say because this is a country that doesn't have accurate opinion polling. You can't really expect people to speak openly on the phone about their political views or about anything else for that matter. So I'm a little bit hesitant to generalize either about, you know, the demographics or the numbers of people who believe this or that. In my sort of anecdotal experience, there's certainly a constituency for the hardliners in Iran. We didn't even get to defining them, but I think maybe by default we understand who they are. And there are these militias known as the Basij, who are enforcers for the Islamic Republic, and those are hardline youth. And this is not a small. I think one of the sort of running jokes I now have with myself is that when I first started going to Iran during the reform period, people would say, well, 80% of Iranians are basically reformists and Democrats, but 20% support the regime, and the trouble is that they will fight to the death. When I started going back after the real clampdown under Ahmadinejad, when I was really only permitted to speak with hardliners, I heard from more than one of them, you know, 80% of the Iranian public thinks like us. It's just 20% that supports reform, and they just happen to be really telegenic and attractive to the Western media. We can't determine for sure which of these views comes closer to the truth. But the most interesting thing to me about their concurrence is that these are two populations that just don't see each other.
You mentioned Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was elected president in 2005. You write about him that, I'm quoting, Iran never had a politician like him. He was like a game show host or a faith healer, a hardline conservative with a populist bent.
Yeah, he was quite a character. There really never was a president or a political figure like him on the Iranian political stage because Iran actually has a pretty elitist political culture. This is a guy who wasn't a cleric. Clerics are highly educated. And he wasn't an intellectual like Khatami, who was both a cleric and an intellectual. He was a man of the people. And he came in really touting that. I was there when he was elected in 2005. And his campaign was really all about how modestly he lived and how he didn't take any perks. And you always saw him in his sort of, you know, dirty windbreaker. And he had his little house in Tehran. And, you know, he was really a populist. And when he came in, he made all kinds of promises. He would go out on these trips to the provinces and just sort of people would come to meetings and say, but our town needs a community center or a swimming pool. And he would say, you got it. And he would just kind of make promises to fund projects without running anything through a budgetary committee or through any process. And then his team would have to kind of struggle behind him to find the funds and make it work. So He came in with these populist economic promises, but in the end, he wound up sort of flooding the economy with liquidity, which resulted in this massive inflation. And by the end, the economy really took its worst turn under Ahmadinejad.
You're listening to Laura Secor. on Iran, history and politics. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We'll talk about the Iranian economy. I mean, from my reading of it, it seems to be some kind of state capitalist amalgam, but it is so oil-driven that that creates enormous distortions.
That's right. It's actually a really unusual economic setup, but to begin with the oil, one interesting thing I learned is that the term rentier economy came from an Iranian economist. And for good reason. When you have an economy that has one resource like oil, and it is, you know, the kind of resource that oil is, this does distort both the economic and political arrangements of the country in particular ways. For instance, the Iranian government does not rely on taxes. It relies on this resource, which it controls. I won't sort of belabor the mechanics of this, but one of the things that became very evident to me over the course of visits there is that this was a country that didn't really care if its middle class was productive. It could effectively block having any independent economic center of power develop because it really didn't need that for its survival. But oil created a dependency that was also really troubling, and one Iranian government after another would set the goal of making the economy less oil dependent and trying to find alternate sources of revenue. But the structure of the economy is really interesting and unique because although at the beginning of the revolution, they had a lot of state-owned enterprises, and that was the structure for some time. Starting in the 90s, structure started to be broken up and reformed. But what they did is they started selling off these state-owned industries, allegedly to private bidders, but really to these kind of semi-private, semi-state entities. A lot of them are called bonyads, and then some of them are owned by the Revolutionary Guard. They're run by clerics or Revolutionary Guards or other sort of interests that are tied to the state, but they're not technically the state. There's actually what economists call this sector of the Iranian economy is parastatal. And this is a ambiguous and kind of not very regulatable part of the economy. It doesn't allow for a lot of independent enterprise because it's very hard to compete with these outfits. On the other hand, it's not exactly controlled by the state.
The Revolutionary Guards, which I believe are under the control of the supreme leader, is also quite, as you suggest, an economic force, a la the military in Pakistan, the military in Egypt, the military in Turkey. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, that really started after the Iran-Iraq War. This was Rafsanjani's brainchild. I think he based it on something observed in Japan. The idea was they now had to demobilize the Revolutionary Guard after the war. And in order to do so and to integrate it into the society without it becoming in any way, I guess, sort of a threat to the balance of power, the idea was to give it some economic interests. So that's the source of the move toward bringing the Revolutionary Guard into the economy. But the Revolutionary Guard has become a very powerful institution in Iran. It began because Khomeini, when he seized power, didn't trust the military, and he sort of established the Revolutionary Guard as a Praetorian Guard. But it has become a real entity unto itself and a major part of the Iranian armed forces, as well as a big domestic player, both politically and economically.
Talk about the status of women in the Islamic Republic. I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that something like two-thirds of all college and university graduates are women?
Yeah, that's right. It's been kind of an interesting thing to keep an eye on because the Islamic Republic in some ways generated a lot of mobility for women, even while it has not figured out a way to absorb that. And the same is true, incidentally, for just class mobility in the country, because under the Islamic Republic, there has been a proliferation of university campuses. They've established universities out in the provinces where there previously were none. They've also done a great job of electrifying villages and making village life a lot more modern and livable, bringing healthcare to the villages and education. So the result has been sort of counterintuitive. On the one hand, you have more rural families sending their daughters to school. And part of that, by the way, was the segregation of the universities made that possible too. So traditional families who might not have wanted to send their daughters to co-ed university campuses were more comfortable with segregated campuses. So a lot more girls started going to school. By the way, this has been catastrophic for the carpet industry, which can no longer employ rural women for slave wages. Women have started to be much more mobile in that part of the country. And it's created a lot more class mobility and the expectation that people can better their lives and move into the middle class. But there's not a lot of space for them in the economy or in the political life of the country. So once they get to that middle class, or once women get their degrees, they then kind of discover that there aren't jobs for them or a place for them. So this is, I think the statistics that always stick in my mind, these are now many years old, but the rate of unemployment for men without advanced degrees is much higher than the rate of employment for women with the most advanced degrees. There are a lot of people who are sort of well-educated and underemployed, which creates political tension.
What about such issues as divorce, property rights, reproductive rights? Are they available?
Those kinds of rights are, there's a discriminatory basis in Iranian law. And that's been what the women's movement has been fighting for the last decade or more.
Well, I was in Iran a few months ago, and I was struck, again, I was only in the capital, this massive, urban concentration of something like 20 million people. Lots of, chic shops, particularly in the northern part of the city. And the presence of so many young people, this has been observed by many commentators, that it's a very young population. That's surely going to have a political impact as they mature.
You would think so, but we've been saying that since 1997. So it's hard to, at some point in 1997, I think we were saying, well, this youth bulge is going to have to change everything politically. And it's been now, two decades. And what we see, there is a large cosmopolitan and somewhat disaffected youth population in Iran. That continues to be the case. And the question really is how long this regime is willing to continue to hold power by clamping it down. Because that's been the decision that it made, particularly in 2009 when it put down the Green Movement, and has since then basically said, we are not sharing power with these reformists. You know, it's our way or the highway.
Just to go back to the women question, what about reproductive rights and access to contraception and abortion?
That's all highly restricted. And it's also one thing that in the book I tell the story of a young woman who became an activist. She really started out as an activist against juvenile execution, but it really her activism began to take in a battery of women's issues, including those kinds of rights and including stoning, which became her real focus in her later years in Iran. And one thing that she discovered that I think was very shocking for her, she came from the north of Iran, which has a more liberal religious culture. And then she moved to Tehran, which is cosmopolitan. And when she discovered that there were young women in the countryside who were being sentenced to execution for what were called crimes against chastity, she was really shocked because this didn't seem to apply to people of her class and of her milieu. So there is a sort of unequal application of these laws that has to do with the judges in particular localities because they have a lot of discretion.
Routinely in U.S. media, particularly today and the political pundit class, they describe Iran as, I'm quoting here, aggressive, assertive, threatening, the leading terrorist state. How do you see a U.S.-Iranian relations evolving in the current political climate?
It's really a puzzle right now. You know, we just came through an unprecedented period since 1979 of détente, in a way. We had the nuclear deal that the Obama administration signed, and it was not only a bilateral U.S.-Iran agreement, but it also included several other world powers. And that agreement still stands for the moment, and it doesn't stand or fall solely on American participation. So there are quite a few factors that will determine what happens with that. The new American administration has a kind of confusing set of priorities, as far as I can see. And until we really know what their strategic vision is, it's going to be hard to say how they're going to handle Iran, because at least as I see it, on the one hand, we're given to understand that the Trump administration wants closer ties with Russia, and even at the expense of the Europeans, and wants not to be involved in, you know, foreign ground wars in the Middle East, wants to crush ISIS. All of this would suggest cooperation with the Russian strategy in Syria and Iraq, and Russia's strategic ally is Iran. So how they square that with the anti-Iranian line that's also coming from Washington at the moment, I can't quite figure. I think that the going assumption is that what they plan to do is to strike a bargain with the Russians and trade Ukraine for Iran and see if they can drive a wedge between Russia and Iran by giving the Russians what they want in Ukraine. I think this is unlikely to go very far, because I don't quite see how any Russian strategy in the Middle East works without Iran.
Trump has on multiple occasions described the Iran deal as a bad deal. But in a talk you gave at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C., you said the deal was good news for Iran and Iranians. In what way was it good news?
It was good news for the part of the Iranian population that seeks connection with the world. There is a lot of Iran that has been that has really not appreciated the isolation that the Ahmadinejad administration brought on the country, and that has been eager for quite some time to rejoin a sort of global community, and that doesn't see the United States or the West as cultural threats or enemies. So for ordinary Iranians and for Iranian civil society, the deal was a step forward. But there was also a part of the Iranian regime that does fear American influence, and that was not very happy to see the deal signed, that also didn't trust it. I think Khamenei's line from the very beginning was, go ahead, sign this deal, but the Americans are not to be trusted. They're not going to stick by it. So the noise coming out of the Trump administration is music to those ears. I think there is a constituency both here and in Iran for mutual hostility, and that, you know, I don't know. I have various different ways that I play this out in my head in terms of how this is going to go, but it seems like they're short of conflict between the U.S. and Iran. There are certainly ways for tensions to ratchet up in ways that serve the interests of anti-American forces over there and anti-Iranian forces over here.
What are Iranian interests, let's say, in Syria and Lebanon and Yemen, where it is involved?
That's complicated, but consider that for the Iranians, if they consider themselves to be functioning pretty much on their own regionally and globally, they don't have a trusted superpower protector, and they worry about the Pakistanis, and they worry about the Saudis. So if you
Why?
Because these are historic antagonisms, and they have opposing interests in the region. For the Iranians, I think that maintaining pressure on Israel is one way that they are able to say, you strike us, we strike them. That requires them to keep Hezbollah and Hamas on their leash. Syria has long been their link for Hezbollah. They also, Assad was their main regional ally, and they don't want to give him up. They are concerned about ISIS because ISIS also sees Shiites as its enemy. They are concerned to root out extreme Sunni jihadism from their borders in Iraq and in Syria. So these are all interests that they have in the region. They also see opportunities. I think pretty much since the U.S. deposed Saddam Hussein, Iran has seen an opportunity to extend its power and influence into Iraq. And all of those interests right now, they have a sort of strategic alliance with Russia in order to sustain those interests. But the relationship between Iran and Russia is not, it's complicated. And there's a long history there, too. It's not a relationship of trust.
Again, this may be a cliche, but one hears that Iranians, separate from the government, form the most pro-American population in the region. Is there anything to that?
That certainly was true during the period of time that I was visiting Iran. I think that that is something that may be really threatened now. I think under Ahmadinejad, there was certainly a period when you saw an uptick in anti-Americanism in Iran, because that was the line that was coming from the state, although it's always been coming from the state. But during the Ahmadinejad period, it was a more unified message. And that really subsided. And I think my experience in Iran was that, yes, this was a surprisingly pro-American population, sometimes more so than Europe. But now, I don't know. I think that in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of damage done to that relationship. I know that on the anniversary of the revolution, which was February 10th, you had Iranians out in the streets with signs. This was actually really quite incredible. You know, normally on that date, there's a lot of burning of American flags and a lot of anti-American symbolism. This year, there was a movement first on social media that was called Love Beyond Flags, and of people saying, don't burn these people's flags. They've been out in the airports protesting the Muslim ban. So what was striking to me was that you had at least some portion of Iranians who were saying, we refuse to associate the American flag with Washington. We're going to associate it with the part of the American public that is protesting the policies out of Washington. So that was an interesting moment. There was one sign that I saw that said something like, down with U.S. regime, long live U.S. people.
Talk about the 2009 election in which Ahmadinejad was elected. There was a huge controversy about voter fraud. Mir Hossein Mousawi was a former prime minister, ran against Ahmadinejad. His wife also campaigned with him, a prominent artist, Zahra Renouard. Both of them are under house arrest today. The demonstrations about that election generated violent response from the state. Could you talk about what happened in 2009?
So Ahmadinejad came into office in 2005. By 2009, he'd governed for 4 years. And in that time, he had promised to improve the economy. The economy actually got worse. There was a crisis of inflation. And there was also a great deal of repression because he came in following a reformist president and he cracked down on dissent and morality. So my feeling, having been there twice for sort of midterm elections during Ahmadinejad's first term, was that the situation was restive and he was not a popular president. And I did really try to hit a lot of different demographics in my visit and to talk specifically to people who had voted for him in 2005, many of whom were dissatisfied by 2008-2009. So in 2009, when the reformists ran two candidates in that election, but the main one really was Mir Hossein Mousavi. Mousavi is an interesting figure. He was prime minister in the 80s. He was part of that radical Islamic left faction that, after they were expelled from power, the rest of the faction became reformists. Mousavi, we don't know, because he was quiet for about 20 years. And some people think that's because Khamenei was president when Mousavi was prime minister and they hated each other. So some people think that Khamenei, when he became supreme leader, basically ordered Mousavi out of politics. That may be so, or maybe Mousavi simply sat it out. We don't know. But when he came to the campaign in 2009, he gave Ahmadinejad a real run for his money because Mousavi was the original populist. He also had connections to the Revolutionary Guard, which Ahmadinejad also did. He was a guy who had credibility with the same population that Ahmadinejad did. And at the beginning, the thought was, that it was going to be conservatives who voted in this election, that reformists would sit it out. They were disillusioned. They didn't really feel like they still had any place in the process. But then something surprising happened in the last, well, really the Iranian elections allow for campaigning mainly in the last 2 weeks before the vote. So in that period, suddenly there was just this surge of support for Mousavi, and you saw the streets fill up with people in green. It was sort of a carnival atmosphere, which I had even like a conservative contact of mine called me and said, this is like the revolution. What's happening here? People are out all hours of the night. Nobody's stopping them. There were televised debates in which Mousavi kind of laid waste to Ahmadinejad. So this was a very festive atmosphere and a lot of energy, a lot of momentum going into it. So on election day, a curious thing happened. Just before the polls closed, the top brass of the reform movement, the campaign managers for the Mousavi campaign and all these former ministers under Khatami were arrested. The campaign headquarters were sacked in a few places. The polls closed and the election results were announced very quickly, which is really weird in Iran because they have paper ballots. I've been there for elections. Usually the results come in very slowly the next day sometime. This time they were announced that night and Ahmadinejad was pronounced the winner by a landslide. There was a lot of disbelief, and some of the people who had been so energized in the streets continued to come out with signs saying, where is my vote? You had, by some estimates, 3 million people in the streets of Tehran alone the day after the election. So there were these massive demonstrations of people saying that they felt that the votes had not been counted, that they thought the election had been stolen, that it wasn't fair, that they didn't trust the outcome. And Mousavi backed the protesters. Long story short, these protests were put down with real violence and brutality. There were reports of people of shooting into crowds. There's the very famous young woman who was caught on YouTube bleeding to death in the street, having been shot for nothing. There were a number of other protesters who turned up dead. Then there were these prisons that were, there was a makeshift prison outside of Tehran where prisoners were abused and raped and died of festering wounds. There were terrible things that happened in this period. And the reformist brass that had been arrested were put on show trials, which to me, this is sort of the climactic concluding scene in a way of my book, because you now see what the regime charges them with. And they charge them with this vast conspiracy in collaboration with Western philosophers and the CIA and the young people who had been out in the streets and the young people who had been working on newspapers. They had all these years, in a sense, been setting these people up with false confessions. And they were charged with a vast campaign of sedition. So this crackdown, I think, while it doesn't get the attention anymore that it merits, this was a major turning point in the domestic politics of Iran. These people were eliminated from the political scene. Their reformist project, which had been an internal project by people who were part of the system, was now placed beyond the pale, labeled seditious, and has been removed from the political space of the Iranian debate.
You, in your book, you write of the deep schisms that rend Iranian society. Do they continue today?
Yeah, I think this is a very divided society. And I now say that advisedly, knowing that we, too, have a divided society. I mentioned to you before the sort of the notion that you have a population that says 80% of us think like this and the others are only 20% and both sides are saying this of each other. This tells you that you have entire worlds within the public that don't even believe that another world exists. So these are significant divisions. And I often felt in Iran when I would tell people who were sort of in the middle class activist world that I was interviewing Basijis or going to certain neighborhoods or certain institutions where I would find hardliners, they would say, you're going there? Like as though it was just, they would never dream of going there. They would never dream of talking to those people. That said, it is one country. And everybody has a relative or a connection of some kind that is on the other side of that divide. So it's while it is divided, it's also like our own country. It's also intertwined. And I guess the question is whether a sort of national reconciliation is possible that would propel the country forward in an inclusive way.
So you think that there's a possibility, given the vibrancy of some sectors of civil society, that there can be some evolution beyond the current model?
I think that has been the struggle that's been going on now since 1997. You have a tremendous civic spirit in Iran, people who continue to flood that space with their optimism and their activism in spite of paying often terrible prices for it.
Thanks very much for your time, Laura.
Thank you so much, David.
You were just listening to an interview I did with Laura Secor on Iran, history, and politics. I talked with her at the University of Denver. Laura Secor has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Foreign Affairs. She's the author of Children of Paradise, The Struggle for the Soul of Iran. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Vandana Shiva, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy, Richard Wolff, Tariq Ali, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Nader Hashmi. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.